Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Kathleen Dean Moore. She's a philosopher, an environmental activist, and a writer. Her most recent book is Moral Ground, Ethical Action for a Planet in Peril, which gathers testimony from 100 of the world's moral leaders about our obligation to the future. Formerly Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at Oregon State University, she's left the university to focus on the climate emergency. She speaks all over the country, calling people to action to prevent carbon catastrophe. You can find her work in magazines such as The Sun, High Country News, and Orion, and on her blog at riverwalking.com. So thank you so much, first, for your incredibly important work, and thank you for also being on the program.
I'm really pleased to be talking with you.
You know, I've said this to you privately a bazillion times, but I also want to just say it publicly that you are one of the very few philosophers who actually makes sense to me and whose work I think is really – I wish that every philosopher were more like you. I think that if every philosopher were more like you, I don't think we would be in the problems that we're in today, because your philosophy is really grounded. It's earth-based. It's very loving, and it's not body-hating. I love it.
That's nice of you to say. Thanks.
Okay, so I would like to start by let's drive right into the philosophy. You claim that climate change is a moral issue. What do you mean?
People tell us that climate change is a scientific issue, and it's a technological issue, and it's an economic issue, and now they're talking about it as a social or a national security issue. But it seems clear to me that it's fundamentally a moral issue, and it calls for a moral response. It's not just stupid. It's not just expensive. It's not just damaging to the national security to wreck the world. It's just wrong. And when this generation takes whatever it wants for our easy lives and we leave this ransacked and destabilized world for our children, that's not worthy of us. That's not worthy of our love for them. And when the corporate bigwigs, in order to increase their profits, which are the biggest profits in the history of money, when they show a willingness as a business plan to take down the great systems that sustain life on Earth, you know, in my most philosophical voice, I would say that that's moral monstrosity on a cosmic scale, and that we should address it as that kind of immorality.
You know, the book I'm almost finishing right now, I'm about three-quarters of the way or four-fifths of the way done, is a book on human supremacism, and which I think is one of the biggest problems facing the planet today. And I've just the last few days been writing about how every article pretty much about an endangered species always has to come back to how this will affect the economy. And you know, you'll read the oceans are being murdered. There are stolid scientists who are saying that the oceans could be devoid of fish within 35 years. And then they will immediately talk about the effects that would have on the economy. And that strikes me as both profoundly insane and profoundly immoral. I mean, why not, the oceans themselves aren't valuable in themselves.
You know, I couldn't agree with you more. People talk about ecosystem services, and that just seems insane to me. They're not ecosystem services as if they were servants or as if they were existed to serve us. Those are ecosystem gifts, and we don't necessarily deserve them. And if they were taken away, there's nothing we could do to get them back. And what we need to develop is a way of thinking about them that's based on gratitude and restraint. I agree with you completely.
And before we get to, the next major question I want to ask is what you're trying to do with your book Moral Ground. But before we get there, I want to ask you a little bit about morality, because that's one of the things I love about you as a philosopher, is that you take on questions like talking about things being moral, when it seems to me that so often morality has been you're not supposed to talk about science and morality in the same sentence, or you're not supposed to talk about the economy and morality. You're not supposed to talk about action and morality. And morality, basically, it seems has almost been ceded to the only people who talk about morality are the religious right. And I love the fact that you talk proudly and openly about the importance of morality.
Yeah, you're right. That's been a devastating thing, I think, that has happened, is the way that discourse about morality has disappeared from the public sphere, and it's hiding behind the brick facades of the churches. And I think partly it's a confusion when people think that we have a right to believe what we want to about morality. They confuse that, which I think we do, with the notion that all that we might think is right, and that there's no way to have a critical discourse about morality without appealing, for example, to God. But morality and ethics and moral discourse are primarily rational discourses. We can bring reasons to bear to support our moral claims. And that's a skill that's been not taught, and it's one that's really missing from the public discourse. So if I could wave my magic wand and make a change that I think would be huge, it would be to teach people suddenly and very quickly how to have a reasoned discourse about what they think is beautiful and true and right and good.
So do you mind if we put off the book Moral Ground for just another question?
Go for it.
I have my own answer for this, but I'd love to hear your answer. That what then, what is moral? How does one determine what is moral?
Well, that the question is, what you're asking is the history of moral philosophy, and I could just, of course, I can just sketch out the structure of an answer. Generally, philosophers say there's really three different approaches to that. If you think about a decision to do something, you think about an act as not just one act, but as on a timeline. If I'm trying to decide, for example, whether to lie to my husband, first, it has its origin in my character and in my intentions. And then I move along that timeline and say I choose to lie, and then that lie lives on and has a certain set of consequences. Where you focus your moral reasoning along that timeline puts you into one of three different moral camps. So on the one hand, there are people who think that morality rests in character and intention, in virtue, in other words, that any acts that spring from a virtuous character are going to be good. Then there are those who focus on the act itself and the nature of the act itself. And they say an act is right or wrong depending on the characteristics of that act. For example, does it conform to a duty? Is it just? Is it, some people say, in accordance with the will of God? And then there are people, almost all Americans, almost all economists, who focus on the consequences. And they say that an act is right or wrong depending on whether its consequences are good or bad. These are utilitarians. These are the consequentialists who judge an act's rightness or wrongness by how it plays out in the world. These are the risk-benefit analysis kind of moralities. Does that help at all?
Yeah, that's and I'm wondering, well, let's keep that in mind, and then we'll sort of weave that into the whole interview. So the next question is let's take it back to the book we mentioned before, Moral Ground, and what are you trying to do with that book?
Right. Well, you know, scientists have reached this consensus: climate change is real, it is dangerous, it is upon us, and they put that word out, and pretty much nothing happened. They were thinking, you know, if people knew, if they only knew, then they would act. And when nothing happened, they said, well, we just need to tell them more effectively. And so, you know, those dear heroes trying to learn how to be communicators and tell people, no, really, everybody, it's real, it's here, it's dangerous. And nothing happened. Because this notion that if people only knew the facts, then they would do the right thing is a fallacy. And in fact, any argument that has a conclusion about what we ought to do is going to have two premises. On the one hand, you wouldn't want to know the facts, the context for your decision. But you can't get from that to a decision about what you ought to do unless you have a second premise. And that's the moral premise, the normative premise, the evaluative premise, the affirmation of what's good, what's worthy of seeking. So if you know the way the world is and what will happen if you act in certain ways, And if you have a clear idea, a clear affirmation of where you want to be and what is right and good, then you can reach a conclusion about what you want to do. But that second premise is missing from the discourse. And so what my co-editor, Michael Nelson, and I were trying to do was create a national conversation about our values. What do we prize? What do we cherish? What do we value? And so we wrote to 100 of the world's moral leaders, people like Desmond Tutu and Thich Nhat Hanh and the Dalai Lama and Derek Jensen. And we asked them all the same question. We said, in 2,000 words or fewer, do we have a moral obligation to the future to leave a world as rich in possibilities as our own? What we were trying to do was create a document of consensus, a moral consensus, that yes, we have an obligation to the future for these reasons. And once again, we wanted people to give reasons. And the essays fell into about 14 different categories of reasons why we ought to honor our obligation to the future, ranging from it's a matter of self-preservation to it's a matter of honoring the intrinsic value of the world. So that no matter what worldview a person brings to the debate, they will find in that book a reason why they need to be climate change activists.
Yeah, I think that this is incredibly important work. And I keep, as you were talking, I kept thinking about how – can you say your second premise again of those two premises?
The first premise is this is the way the world is. The second premise, to put it shortly, is this is the way the world ought to be.
And I think that that's a big part of the problem, is that the morality of the dominant culture, if we look at this in terms of what it values, then that's all messed up because, you know, Robert J. Lifton talks extensively about claims to virtue and how about before you can commit any mass atrocity, you have to convince yourself that what you're doing is actually good. So the Nazis were actually not, from their own perspective, committing genocide, but instead purifying the Aryan race. And so a lot of this, they're not actually murdering the planet, but instead they're developing natural resources, helping the economy, et cetera, et cetera. And for me, a lot of it comes down to what is valued. And that leads to the question of ethics. And do you think ethics changes anything? And what are ethics? And what's the point of all this discussion that you're doing of casting this as a moral issue? And do ethics change anything? And what are the ethics that are currently in place? And what would you like to see?
You know, people often say that to me, you know, you are being naive. It's economics that drives the world, and ethics has a backseat. And I think that's a misreading of history. When I read history, and particularly the United States, as cynical as we might be, almost every major turn that we've made, every social change that happened and dramatically changed the way things happen, was the result of a rising wave of moral affirmation or moral indignation, a rising wave of commitment to a moral principle. And you can look through history and find all kinds of examples. For example, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. That's a moral principle. And as people affirm that moral principle, the great monarchies in Europe fell. Or how about this one? All persons held as slaves within any state shall be then thenceforward and forever free. You know, that was the affirmation, at least in the North, that this, that slavery was wrong, that caused this enormous change in the way we do business in the United States. Or how about I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up? How about hell no, we won't go? And it just seems to me that what we're lacking in the climate change struggle is a declaration of independence, and we're lacking a dream. What if people stood up and they said, no, I'm not going to let the fossil fuel industries and their hired politicians make me a foot soldier in the war against the world. No, I'm going to invent better choices than they are offering me. Or what if we had a shared dream, something like, I've been trying to figure out how to say this in a slogan, the earth shall be healed and whole again. And it seems to me that that kind of affirmation can be the basis of a movement in a way that economics cannot. You know, the only thing that trumps an economic claim, like this would make us a lot of money, is a moral claim. Yeah, but that would be wrong. And I'm not saying that that always happens, but I think people recognize that that's what ought to happen.
So what are some of the sort of categories under which we have a moral obligation to stop climate change? It seems pretty clear that, for me at least, the bottom line is the oceans need to not be murdered and the forests need to not be murdered. And so what are some of the reasons that we have a moral obligation to stop climate change? It seems like a pretty clear and obvious question, but when the world's being destroyed, I don't think we can take anything for granted in terms of the necessity to articulate these things.
Right. And you say that the ocean shouldn't be murdered and the forest shouldn't be murdered. And then the question is, why? What reason would you bring to back up your claim? Oh gosh, I could pick out so many. Let me start with human rights. Although it's an anthropocentric argument that we can go beyond, I think we might want to start there, because if there's anything that people around the world really believe, it's that people have a right to life, liberty, and security of person. But climate change, by threatening to undermine the foundation of those rights, is promising us the worst, most massive violation of human rights the world has ever seen. The destruction of the basis of people's lives. The destruction of the ice, which is destroying the lives of the Inuit people just as surely as the destruction of buffalo destroyed the ways of life of the Plains Indians. The way that climate change is going to undermine agricultural systems and there will be hungry people on the move. You know, Catherine Bateson anticipates this and she said, you know, the worst fear that I have is that the answer to climate change is going to be a nuclear winter. And when she said that, I just was stunned. But geologically speaking, yes, if our Earth is warming, and if that warming is causing massive disruption and massive violation of human rights, and if people won't put up with it, and if it moves us towards war, it's possible that it would be a nuclear war, because many of the nations most deeply affected are nuclear powers. And we've heard Carl Sagan talk about the way in which the dust and the destruction of a nuclear war would raise so many particulates in the atmosphere that it would create a rapid cooling. So I can't say strongly enough that this has a human rights challenge that we are morally obliged to meet. But that's just the beginning, you know. We could talk about justice. It's not just that people are going to suffer, although they will. It's that they're going to suffer unjustly. And that those of us who are enjoying these advantages of the profligate use of fossil fuel are offloading the costs onto people who have no voice to protest, or onto beings who have no voice to protest. And I would list them as future generations, plants and animals, ecosystems, marginalized people, people who are on the geological or geographical and the economic margins, and children. You know, philosophers, you know, have, I know that you're not sure that we have quite so much worth, but philosophers have figured out what our fair share of the atmosphere's carbon absorbing capacity is. So, and what they've done, this is Peter Singer's work, he's simply taken the number of people in the world and divided it into the amount of carbon, how much the atmosphere can collect carbon dioxide without a dramatic change of the climate, and come up with the number of how many tons of carbon dioxide we each have as our right, which, by the way, is to say nothing of the plants and animals, but setting that aside for the moment. It turns out, when I looked at the numbers, that I have a right, a fairness, if we were dealing fairness, I would use about one-seventh of the carbon-carrying capacity of the atmosphere as I'm now using. That's useful to know, because I think I can do that. But we've been talking about people, and it's far beyond that. I mean, the real, to me, the sin of climate change is the damage that it's doing to to the natural world. It's a failure of reverence to grind up this whole world, to grind up the plants and grind up the animals and make them all into human biomass. You know, I was just reading the other day that the prediction that by 2050, there will be 50% fewer plants and animals on this planet. And that really, really matters, because what's left of the world is what evolution has to work with. You know, what's left of the world is the genetic material that is going to create whatever comes next. So when we eliminate a species, we're not just eliminating a species, we're eliminating a whole host of possibilities. And that seems to me to be a violation of our duties of reverence. That seems to me to be a profanity. Shall I keep going?
Yeah, please do.
Okay. Well, then the reason for acting on climate change that most strongly speaks to me as a mother and as a grandmother is that if we fail to act on climate change, we will have betrayed our children. You know, these kids didn't make this mess, and they don't deserve what's coming at them like a freight train. 500 scientists from Stanford send out a consensus statement saying that if we don't take immediate action, by the time today's children are middle-aged, the life support systems of the planet will be irretrievably damaged. Dear God, the children? You know, Brian Doyle is a wonderful Portland poet, and I asked him to speak to this issue about the betrayal of the children. I said, what do we owe the children? Why should we honor their future? And he wrote, because we swore and vowed to every God we ever imagined or invented or dimly sensed that we would care for them with every iota of our energy when they came to us miraculously from the sea of stars. Because they are the very definition of innocent, and every single blow and shout and shiver of fear that rains down on them is utterly undeserved and unfair and unwarranted. Because we used to be them, and we remember dimly what it was like to be small and frightened and confused. I think that is exactly right. And to what Brian said, I would also add, because we promised them. You know, I don't know a parent who didn't hold a newborn child in her arms and promise them the world. I would do anything for you. I would give you the world. And what's the one thing that we're doing? We're taking away the world that we promised them. It's unconscionable. So that's four reasons, Derek, why I think that this is, why I think we have a moral obligation to take action. Because of our duties towards human rights, because of our duties of justice, because of our duties to be reverent and respectful toward the earth, and because of our absolute obligations to the children.
You know, you're talking about what the children today will face, and I'm very close to my mom, and she's in her 80s now, and we talk a fair amount. Both of us are glad that we're not younger, because neither of us can bear to see what is happening. And, you know, she goes back further than I do. And even if you go back, her grandmother grew up in a sod house on the prairie and was afraid sometimes when she was a little girl. She was always afraid of thunderstorms because she thought that they would spook the bison, and the bison would trample their house. And how wonderful that would be to be living in a world where you're afraid the bison are going to trample your house.
Well, I'm not sure, but it's certainly a wonderful world, the world of the bison and the grapes.
Yeah. And how that's her grandmother, so that's, you know, what, four generations from the children today. And, you know, we're seeing, you know, even I've lived in Northern California for 15 years now, and little tiny blue butterflies have disappeared in that time. Newts have disappeared, salamanders, frogs are disappearing. Just, it's happening so fast. And I don't know about you. Well, actually, I think I do know about you, but I am not a depressed person. I'm actually a very happy person personally. And it's very hard to get up every morning knowing that 200 more species have gone extinct that day. And it's, I can't, or like meadowlarks. I grew up in, on the plains of Colorado, and meadowlarks were everywhere. It's one of my favorite sounds on the entire planet. And, I've recently learned that meadowlark populations are in free fall, and it's very, even for those of us who are not children, it is very, very, very painful. And that's one of the costs, is seeing this. I mean, I can't imagine what it would be like to be living on a world that is not being torn apart day by day.
I know, imagine. Pardon. I'm sorry.
So this becomes, I mean, everything you said about the children, this is very personal, and as well as ecological, political, social, it's also very personal. I mean, has this become a personal crusade for you?
It has, and you know, your mention of the meadowlarks reminds me of this piece that I wrote for the Moral Ground book. Forgive my voice, it's very smoky in the Willamette Valley today. We have forest fires. Well, there you go. But I wonder if you, if I might read just this very short 3-4 minute essay that strikes exactly the tone that you're talking about. I think it's really important. One of the jobs of the writers is the work of witness, to be able to look at this square in the eye and to try to put it into words, try to put into words what really can't be said. So I wrote this piece that's called The Call to Forgiveness at the End of the Day. And it's the dateline on it is May 25th, 2025. So as a writer, I'm imagining us 10 years in the future. All those years, the Swainson's thrushes were the first to call in the mornings. That's when I would take a cup of tea and walk into the meadow. Swallows sat on the highest perches, whispering as they waited for light to stream onto the pond. For years, there were flocks of goldfinches. After my husband and I poisoned the bull thistles on the far side of the pond, the goldfinches perched in the willows. The garbage truck backed down the lane, beeping its backup call, making the frogs sing even in the day. Oh, there was music in the mornings all those years. In the overture to the day, each bird added its call until the morning was an ecstasy of music that faded only when the diesel pumps kicked on to pull water from the stream. Evenings were glorious, too. Just as the sun set, little brown bats began to fly. If a bat swooped close, I heard its tiny sonar chirps just at the highest reach of my hearing. Frogs sang all evening and into the night. They sang while crows flew into the oaks and settled their wings, while garter snakes, their stomachs extended with frogs, crawled finally under the fallen bark of the oaks and stretched their lengths against cold ground. In the years when the frog choruses began to fade, scientists said it was a fungus, or maybe bullfrogs were eating the tadpoles. No one knew what to do. When the bats stopped coming, they said that was a fungus too. When the goldfinches came in pairs, not flocks, we told each other the flocks must be feeding in a neighbor's field. No one could guess where the thrushes had gone. The fields were as empty as the perfect emptiness of a bell, the perfectly shaped absence ringing the angelus, the evening song, the call for forgiveness at the end of the day. In spring, when our granddaughter was born, I brought her to the pond so she could feel the comfort I had known there for so many years. Kildare wallowed in the mud by the shore, but not so many as before. Ahead of the coming heat, butterflies fed in the mud between the cracks, unrolling their tongues to touch salty soil. I held my granddaughter in my arms and sang to her then an old lullaby that made her soften like wax in a flame, molding her little body to my bones. She fell asleep in my arms unafraid. I will tell you, I was so afraid. Poets warned us, writing of the heartbreaking beauty that will remain when there is no heart to break for it. But what if it's worse than that? What if it's the heartbroken children who remain in a world without beauty? How will they find solace in a world without wild music? How will they thrive without green hills edged with oaks? How will they forgive us for letting frog songs slip away? It isn't enough to love a child and wish her well. It isn't enough to open my heart to a bird-graced morning. Can I claim to love a morning if I don't protect what creates its beauty? Can I claim to love a child if I don't use all the power of my beating heart to preserve a world that nourishes children's joy? Loving is not a kind of la-di-da. Loving is a sacred trust. To love is to affirm the absolute worth of what you love and to pledge your life to its thriving, to protect it fiercely and faithfully for all time. Ring the angelus for the salmon and the swallows. Ring the bells for frogs floating in bent reeds. Ring the bells for all of us who did not save the songs. Holy Mary, Mother of God, Ring the bells for every sacred emptiness. Let them echo in the silence at the end of the day. Forgiveness is too much to ask. I would pray for only this, that our granddaughter would hear again the little lick of music, that grace note toward the end of a meadowlark song. Meadowlarks. There were meadowlarks. They sang like angels in the morning.
Well, thank you for that. It's very, you know, I said it's hard to get up in the morning facing this, and the reason I do every day is because I know that no matter how much I'm feeling this, that it's so much worse for the meadowlarks and the frogs and the thrushes. And it's one of the things I love about your work is that it's, you know, it's very clear who your work is for. And I want to appreciate and honor that. So I guess, you know, who, I don't know how often you get this, but I get this all the time, that it's like, okay, you know, you're railing against this culture, you're railing against, the corporations, you're railing against capitalism, you're railing against all these, the patriarchy, civilization, all these things. But, you know, you drive a car, and they always throw that line at me that I just hate by Pogo. We've met the enemy, and the enemy is us. I was like, oh, for God's sake. So, what do you think about all that?
I think it's one of the biggest triumphs of big oil to make the consumers blame themselves for climate change, even while those corporations are spending billions of dollars to transform us into these mindless consumers of self-destructive consumer goods and fossil fuels. It burns me up. And to make us blame ourselves, even as they make sure that we don't have alternative ways to heat our homes or get to work or travel to our jobs. Or so when I hear people say we met the enemy and he is us, I think we should think about that really carefully, because of course we should spend and invest and work and travel more thoughtfully. And of course we should dramatically cut our use of fossil fuels. But that said, the big oil corporations are happy to claim that they're responding to public demand, but they are manipulating public demand. I mean, I'm not the one who's building the infrastructures that force consumers to use fossil fuels. I'm not the one who's buying politicians so that they'll kill or lethally underfund alternative energy initiatives. I'm not the one who's increasing demand for energy-intensive products through this advertising. I'm not the one who's creating confusion about the harmful effects of burning fossil fuels. And I'm not the one who's trying to influence elections. So give me a break. Yeah, we've met the enemy, and I'm going to do everything I can to make sure it's not me. But while big oil is externalizing all its other costs on me, I'm not going to let big oil externalize the moral shame. That's what it is. It's an attempt to externalize shame, and I'm just not going to buy it.
I think there's a difference between taking responsibility and feeling shame. That years and years ago, back before I understood things a little bit better, I was saying to Jeanette Armstrong, Okanagan Indian writer and activist,
yeah, right.
I said, oh my God, I feel so terrible. I'm responsible for global warming. Because I drive a car. And she said, for crying out loud, don't take responsibility, because you didn't create car culture. If you had never been born, car culture would still be here. And of course, take responsibility for what you do, but your real responsibility is to shut down car culture. Your responsibility is not to complain. Another thing that kills me about all this is there's a salmon-bearing stream right behind my home, and it doesn't have very many salmon. But okay, they kill the salmon, and then I'm supposed to feel guilty because I buy food at the grocery store? That's nuts.
Right.
Anyway, so, but there's another part of this is like, we also not only hear that we're the enemy, we also hear we're all victims, that everybody's a victim of the system. And does that make sense to actually talk about? And one reason I love asking you about these questions is because you know, my work is really focused on, so many indigenous people have said to me, the first and most important thing we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And part of that is to recognize that, is to separate ourselves from the system and not necessarily separate as in, is morally and ethically separate ourselves from the system to start with. And so, you know, when the system is destroying everybody, does it really make sense to talk about specific villains and enemies?
Yeah, it does. That's what courage is, isn't it? You know, people say, oh, you know, we have no human enemies. Everyone is a victim of the system. Everyone is controlled by a system that has gone terribly, terribly wrong. Well, isn't that what courage is? To buck the system? And isn't that what moral courage is to buck an immoral system or a system that pushes people towards immorality? So when people say, you know, these big, oh, Rex Tillerson and the heads of all these big oil companies, you know, they're just people. They're just trying to make a living. And if you ask them, they'll say they're trying to heat your home. Why would you villainize them? And I think the answer to that is because they are doing something dreadfully, dreadfully wrong and hiding behind the system to justify it. I call for moral outrage. You know, I call for name calling. I call for this, well, I call for what my Buddhist friends call fierce compassion. I can feel sorry for a head of a company, and I can understand that the head of that company is doing something wrong, maybe that he doesn't realize. At the same time, I want to be ferocious in my condemnation of that. And I don't want to understand the world into a chaotic state. So when people ask me, please, please don't demonize, you know, what can a person say, Derek, except that I'm trying very hard to tell the truth. And if there are people out there who are doing demonic things, I mean, taking down the life support systems of the world, if there are people there who are doing demonic things, shouldn't we say so?
You know, it all reminds me of something that about Adolf Eichmann, that as part of his trial, one of the things he said was that nobody ever told him that what he was doing is wrong. And it's like, oh, for people who don't know, Adolf Eichmann was was central to the Holocaust. And he later said nobody told him what he was doing is wrong. It's like, well, okay. So that means it's partly your job, Kathleen, and my job to actually tell people, no, you've been warned, you know, what you're doing is wrong. Which all this brings us also to, what about the people who deny the reality of climate change? You've talked about different forms of deniers, old deniers and new deniers. And can you talk about that distinction?
Right. Well, the old deniers are the people who are saying that climate change isn't real, or if it's real, it's not caused by human activities. And, you know, those people, ones who say it's just not happening, I'm not very worried about them. There aren't that many of them who just flat out deny it. In fact, the numbers of the flat-out deniers are about 9% of the population. And that's roughly equal to the number of people who think that Elvis Presley is still alive. So let them think it, you know. Let them think it. They will learn. The earth will be their teachers. The ones that I'm worried about more, far more, are the new deniers. And this is a far larger group of people in the United States. Those who say, yeah, climate change is real and it's dangerous and it's upon us. But, you know, there's nothing that I can do. I deny the possibility of ever making a difference. And so I'm going to enjoy my life. Don't ask anything else of me. And this kind of denying is not so much denying climate change as denying both responsibility to act and the possibility of making a difference. And that, I think, is very, very dangerous. So when people say to me, you know, why are you out there on the road preaching to the choir? I say, I'm out there preaching to the choir because so many of the members of the choir are hypocrites. And they talk the faith, but they don't change the way they act. And if we could just summon the energy and the moral courage of the people who are stuck, and bless their souls, of course we feel stuck. But if we could move those people off the dime, then we would have a solid majority, and we could go forward.
Yeah, it's always just infuriated me how all the excuses that people will find to not act. First, it's not happening. I mean, it's almost predictable. Actually, it is predictable. Okay, you know, it's not really happening. oh no, it may be happening, but there's nothing we can do about it. It's like, where is this step? I mean, with the earth at stake, where is this step of resisting? But you miss the middle step, and not you. They miss the middle step, and it just, once again, I'm sorry to be such a brown noser here, but it's one of the things I love about your work is that I mean, you say these things that are so damn obvious that nobody says. And so once again, thank you. So, but that does lead to the question, you know, they say, oh gosh, nothing we can do. Which, and people ask me why I do my work, and I'm not an optimist. I think things are going to be very, very bad. Things are unimaginably bad, and things are going to get unimaginably worse. And that doesn't alter the fact that if there is 0.00001% chance that all of my work will make things even the tiniest bit better for frogs or sea snakes or little brown bats or anybody or human children, it doesn't matter to me. It's all the same thing. Then I've got to do it. You know, it's like we can't predict the future. So I don't want to look back at the end of my life and say, well, I could have done something. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And the thing is that kills me, sorry to get so I can hear my voice getting thin and reedy, but it's the thing that kills me about this too is if this were people's children under specific direct threat, you know, it's like you don't go, oh, what the hell, you know, there was no chance, so see ya, kiddo. You know, you do whatever it is you can to protect those you love. You don't jump from saying, oh, nothing bad's going to happen, to saying, oh, it's too late, forget it. It's like I was thinking about this, that you know, you're driving a car at 100 miles an hour toward a brick wall, and, you know, you're in a tunnel, so you can't drive away. You don't say, oh gosh, it's too late to stop the car. What you do is you put your foot on the brake so hard, your foot goes through the floor, because you'd rather hit the wall at 70 than 100, and you'd rather hit the wall at 50 than 70. You know, when it comes to that, every mile an hour that you're going slower is a better chance of saving the lives of those you love.
That's a terrific analogy. I think that is absolutely terrific. And I hope that lots and lots of people are listening to you, Derek. Thank you for saying that.
Well, and it gets to the question of is it too late to stop climate change, whatever that means exactly. You know, it's obviously too late for passenger pigeons at this point, you know, and it's too late for the 200 species that went extinct today. But is it too late for the oceans? Is it too late to stop runaway climate change? And what do you say about that?
Oh boy, you know, I think bad things are going to happen. But I do think that this is the hinge decade. I mean, this is the time to step up. This is, you know, you could drive a nail through this decade, and the whole of the planetary history is swinging in the balance. And I genuinely believe that we have reached a tipping point, a social tipping point. People talk about the biological tipping points or the geophysical chemical tipping points, and those are terrifying things. But we should think also about human beings, and I think that we are close on to a social tipping point. And I think the world is absolutely holding its breath. It's the top of the hill when the marble could roll either way. You know, Exxon is hanging out, just kind of hedging its bets, waiting to see which way it goes. And politicians, and even Oregon's governor, I think, is hemming and hawing, almost incoherently, hedging their bets, trying to see which way it goes. And universities are stalling about divestment, just waiting to see if anyone makes them do the right thing. And you remember, did you hear John Kerry, the Secretary of State, beg the American people? He said, make us do the right thing. I mean, this is what a tipping point looks like, and we are there. So, you know, can we push this beautiful blue marble down the other side of a hill? I don't know, but if we can, it's going to be now. I agree with you that there's no hesitating at this point. This is the time that calls all of us to the streets.
So we have like 5 or 6 minutes left, and there were still a few more things I wanted to ask you. So I'm going to ask you these in a bunch. I know you've got 5 or 6 minutes I'm sorry to cut you short, but 5 or 6 minutes to sort of nail all these. And first is something that I think bothers you and I both, is the notion that oh, and here's another entirely predictable response to global warming is, okay, yeah, we agree that climate change is happening, so we just need to adapt. And then the other question is, what frightens you most about climate change? And then the last question that I want to ask about all this is, what can any one person do? So if you can handle those three in 5 or 6 minutes,
I will do my best. So I oftentimes ask my audiences to take a quiz, and I say, you know, if your house is on fire, what will you do? A, try to destroy the careers of the people who called 911. B, debate endlessly as to whether the fire was caused by human agency, like arsons, or natural causes, like lightning. C, appoint a commission to study how best to adapt in the burnt-out shell of what was once the most beautiful house in the world, in the solar system, maybe in the galaxy. And, of course, it's so obvious. What do you do when your house is on fire? You put out the damn fire, and you don't take any of those other steps. So my concern about adaptation, number one, is that it's distracting us from the real business at hand. It becomes a kind of collusion. Maybe I can be safe. Maybe I can find a way to keep the seas from my front porch. And so we stop doing the obvious thing, which is to stop it in its tracks, stop this carbon catastrophe. So if the work of adaptation takes 1 ounce of energy or money from the work of stopping the catastrophe, then I can't imagine how it could be justified. The other thing that worries me about adaptation is that it seems to be, in the ways that I have seen it working, solidifying in concrete, in concrete walls, the kinds of injustices that caused climate change in the first place. You know, to make sure that we are safe, the rest of the world be damned, to make sure that our city is protected by a concrete wall, not remembering or not wanting to remember that concrete that you're pouring into that wall has carbon costs that are going to be paid by your grandchildren. So I'm not a big fan of adaptation, and I'm saying to people that there ought to be this new drinking game where whenever you're in a committee meeting and somebody says the word adaptation, you should stand up and you should say, stop this madness. And then, you know, if people want to take a drink, then they can. But, let me just go by what frightens me the most. It's, the answer to that is ocean acidification. And the destruction of the, food web in the ocean. I think that that's going to be the next most terrifying thing. What can one person do? You know, I was, for one thing, when people say, what can one person do? I want to say, stop being one person. You know, join up with the group. It's lonely out there if you think you're the one that has to save the world, and it's arrogant. But there's real joy in coming together into a community of caring where everyone is doing their part. So that if someone says to me, you know, okay, what's one thing I can do? It's to join a group and help save the future by sharing whatever gifts the good earth has given you. Can you lick a stamp? Can you push save? Are you an organizer and so forth? And here's the point, and maybe we could end with this metaphor, Derek. What do I have, 2 minutes?
Sure.
Okay. So I was up in Denali National Park in June, and it was 93 degrees. This is in Alaska. It was 93 degrees at midnight. We were sweltering, and I couldn't sleep, and I walked down to this river. It was this beautiful East Fork of the Toklat River. And I started to study it because I was thinking, how in God's name are we ever going to stop this river? It's incised into the ground. It's flowing with this terrific force. And every ounce of snow that it melts comes flowing down in the flood. How will we ever stop the river? And then a root ball fell off the bank beside me, and it floated down the river, and it lodged up against the stone. And I could see that where that had made that obstruction, it had slowed the current. The current had dropped some of its load, and right before my eyes, it had turned the current in the opposite direction. And I was thinking, you know, and I looked at another stone, and I could see that every stone in that river was altering that current and in many cases absolutely reversing it and creating new spaces and a new river. And I remembered my geology class that when a river is slowed enough, it drops its load, and if it can't keep going, then it flips into a different state. And that's called an avulsion. And we've seen that where rivers kind of block themselves and then flip into another course. And I was thinking, yeah, we don't have to stop the river. What we have to do is turn that river. And each of us can create an obstruction. Each of us can create a deflection in the current. Each of us can slow that river. And it's by these multiple efforts that we can get that evulsion to take place, that we can get a new course. And so when I think about, when people ask me what to do, I say, find your rock and heave it in. Doesn't matter what it is, as long as it changes that flow. Think of something better, a better way to do it. Say no to something horrible. And that has made me immensely cheerful, Derek, to think about how all around the world there are people picking up a rock and chucking it into that stream.
Well, as I've said so many times, thank you so much for your work. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Kathleen Dean Moore. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.